after year.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle. Well, wait a minute. It's from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as a Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading for you from the Reminisce magazine. And we'll, I think, remember where we were in July of 1969. This issue of the magazine talks about, and so we can reminisce about that time when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon for the first time in human history. The instant he touched down, Neil Armstrong changed history. The moon, so familiar yet so unreachable, was suddenly a discovered frontier. Alien and gray it was, as Buzz Aldrin remarked seconds later. Beautiful, beautiful, magnificent desolation. As the world tuned in, it was not the moon's surface that enthralled us as much as what it meant to land there. In that moment, the limits of human endeavor seemed boundless. And in the darkness of space, we saw only dazzling possibility. T-minus 3 hours to lift off. Just before dawn, July 16, 1969, spectators lined the runway near the roadway near the Kennedy Space Center on Florida's Cape Canaveral to await the launch of Apollo 11's Saturn V. The rocket is rolled out. That was rolled out on May 20. T-minus 2.5 hours. Neil Armstrong front and Buzz Aldrin approach the rocket. Behind them in suit technician Joe Smith. Third Apollo 11 crew member Michael Collins boards at 7 a.m. T-minus 0 hours. Below, the picture shows the members of the Space Center team rise from their desks to watch Apollo 11's liftoff at 9:32 a.m. Eastern Time. Other little sidebars along this story. As you see the pictures in the magazine with the personnel inside the Launch Control Center, watch as Apollo 11 soars into the sky. President Lyndon Johnson and Vice President Spiro Agnew watch liftoff from the VIP viewing stand outside the center. T-plus 0 hours. The Saturn V rocket climbs toward orbit in a plume of rocket fire in a photo taken with a telescopic camera from an Air Force plane. The spacecraft reaches its altitude of 39 miles in less than 3 minutes of powered flight. Walking on air, in wartime, a young soldier bends the rules to listen in on history. When the lunar lander reached the moon and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin aboard the 1969, I was in Vietnam with a 65 Engineer Battalion, which was attached to the 25th Infantry Division at the Army base in Bae Con Chu. It was about to start my shift on guard duty in the motor pool, not wanting to miss the milestone of the first man on the moon. I slipped my transistor radio into my uniform pocket just before my shift. Transistor radios weren't allowed on guard duty, so I hid under a truck to keep an eye out for the sergeant while I tuned in to the broadcast. I'll never forget the excitement of listening to the moon landing while lying under that truck, the surge of patriotism, and the pride running through me was wonderful. I was lucky that the guard sergeant didn't make his rounds then, because I was so caught up in what was I was hearing that I probably wouldn't have noticed him. The experience remains the best memory from my time as a combat engineer in Vietnam and one of the best of my life. Succeeding generations may never fully appreciate how momentous the moon landing was at the time and continues to be for my generation. having lived through so many tragic events for America since then, from school shootings to terror attacks, we cherish the positive memory of that historic moment. This was McGary Pettigo of Brighton, Colorado. T-minus 6 hours to touchdown. The command and service modules in lunar orbit with Collins on board, as seen from the lunar lander on its descent orbit. Below, Adrian checks the lunar module in a photo collage done by Apollo Lunar Service Journal contributor John Hancock, and the pictures of the different inside the capsules, and watching also, there's a picture of the lunar lander as they watch and approach the touchdown. And a reminisce story by Dwayne Lyon of Oakwood, Georgia. He writes, in 1969, I was an airman stationed in the hill of Italy, living with my wife and baby daughters in a small apartment 20 miles from the base. We couldn't afford a TV, but there were no English language stations anyway. When Apollo 11 was about to land, the few Italians who did on sets brought them out to the sidewalk so anyone could watch. It was a thrill for me to hear everything in English before the Italian translation, but you could feel everyone's pride as we watched together. T-minus 0.25 hours. 15 minutes after stepping onto the moon, Armstrong captures Adrian's ascent down the module ladder in a series of photographs. And you can see in each photograph he took in succession as Armstrong goes down the ladder and reaches Earth. Judy Jones of Wichita, Kansas writes, our hearts were in it. A thrilling night on the coronary unit. When the duty roster was posted, my heart sank. I worked in the coronary care at the Mercy Hospital in Mason City, Iowa, and was scheduled for the evening shift on July 20th, 1969. The planned date of the first moonwalk. Perhaps it's hard to believe now how much excitement we all felt about seeing what was on the moon. But at that time, no one would have missed it for the world. Our coronary unit consisted of four rooms, each opening onto a central desk area, and was staffed by two nurses. We were only half full that night, and the two patients were as eager as we were to see the event. We didn't know the exact time of the walk, but our anticipation was palpable. Instead of staying at the desk, the other nurse and I took a patient and sat next to their beds, alternating between watching the heart monitors on the TVs. We all talked enthusiastically to each other from the rooms, the four of us united like a family, sharing this unforgettable moment. We cheered together when Neil Armstrong touched the surface of the moon. When it was over, each patient had a souvenir of the occasion, an EKG strip showing their heart rhythm at that exact moment of the moon landing. I'm happy to say normal sinus rhythm prevailed throughout all the excitement. Back to the future. The next generation. 40 years after the astronauts first walked on the moon, I was in Florida to see the launch of the Space Shuttle Endeavour. My daughter's Dawn's husband, Tim Kopra, was aboard. Tim lived on the International Space Station for 2 months in 2009 and then returned for 6 months in 2015 as the Expedition 47 commander. In all, Tim has spent 244 days in space. A picture of him is shown here as he's doing a spacewalk, one of the three he did. Sitting in front of the TV in 1969, holding baby Dawn, I waited for Neil Armstrong to take his one small step, never dreaming what was to come, writes Betty Lehman of Lewisburg, Kentucky. The great leap forward for NASA is to return to the moon, this time to assess it for a permanent settlement. In April, the agency said it wants to send a mission to the moon's south pole by 2024. These plans lend new urgency to the ongoing research of sample moon rocks. Astronauts gathered over six lunar missions from 69 to 72. In all, astronauts collected 2,200 samples weighing 382 kilograms or 842 pounds. A small part of that collection, studied by scientists all over the world, has yielded remarkable findings, including the now widely held theory that the moon formed from molten rock about 4.35 billion years ago. In 2008, scientists found water molecules in volcanic glass beads from lunar soils. Today, some experts believe the moon may contain as much water as Earth. The hope of learning more over time, aided by sophisticated tools, prompted NASA to preserve about 80% of its lunar samples, in part to commemorate Apollo 11's 50th anniversary. NASA chose earlier this year to open a sample that had been sealed on the moon and divided it among a few labs for scientific study. The rest of the collection remains lovingly cared for, as NASA's Frank McCubing told Science News, making sure we curate those samples in a way that our grandchildren and their grandchildren can keep making discoveries critically important. Hope this, those of you who are old enough to remember that moon landing, I'm sure this 50th anniversary in October, this past October, was really significant. And for me, matter of fact, you couldn't know that while sitting here at the controls, I hit the pause button several times because remembering that year was simply marvelous in many, many ways. Not only for me watching those grainy black and white pictures of Neil Armstrong taking those steps down the ladder, but that October was the birth of my first son. And so he's turned 50 this year, so remarkably, I did have to hit pause there several times and catch up my breath a little bit. So I hope you'll bear with me. Anyway, it was great to relive that story with you. And for generations who didn't have an opportunity to see that, I hope they will enjoy that moment in time. Now from the Our Lives section of the magazine and Our Heroes, Medic treated fellow POWs. Doc Collins didn't turn down a chance to get in the ring with enemy guard. This is by William Brewer of Leander, Texas. He writes, "My stepfather, J.C. Doc Collins, was a combat medic in the Army during World War II. He fought in North Africa and Italy, and after D-Day, he landed in France. Doc was captured September 25, 1944, while tending his wounded troops. His company had pulled back and it was raining. Doc wasn't paying attention to his surroundings until a pair of boots appeared in front of him. When he saw they were black, he knew he was in the wrong place. The Germans processed him as a POW, moving him to a camp outside Frankfurt, Germany. There they allowed him to care for the wounded and injured Allied troops, mostly pilots and their air crew. Doc was a Choctaw from Oklahoma, and the Germans were intrigued. He managed to trade cigarettes with them for wine and save the wine to give all the POWs a very happy Thanksgiving. Doc had been a champion boxer back home. When the Germans saw him sparring, Doc got to box a Russian and a Frenchman, but his favorite was a camp guard. He told me, I knocked them all on their coon dog, but I really enjoyed smacking that German. In February 1945, the camp commander asked if the prisoners wanted to walk toward the American lines. All that could set out, but some had frozen or swollen feet. Doc stayed with them about a week until they could walk too. They trudged 345 miles to Lubeck, Germany, arriving in May. Doc spoke freely of the war, but never gave details about that march. Doc was soon on a boat to New York, very happy to be going back to Oklahoma. He was discharged, but then the Korean War broke out in 50, and of course, he couldn't just stay home. But that's another time, another story for another time, writes William Brewer of Leander, Texas. I'd like some of that. This is a true love story by Mary Narcus of Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. She writes, when my sister Bonnie came home from the Peace Corps in Tanzania in 1966, I was working downtown, so we found an apartment together in Milwaukee's Little Italy, surrounded by Italian-American families. It was an enchanting and eye-opening change from the suburban neighborhood I'd grown up in. After 6 months, my sister rejoined the Peace Corps in Korea, and I was moving out. I just had spaghetti and meatballs for lunch when I heard a rap on the door. There was the landlady with three fellows to see the apartment. She was supposed to give me 24-hour notice before showing up. What was I supposed to do? Of course, I let them in. She led two guys to the living room, but one followed me back into the kitchen. What's for lunch? He asked. Despite his brazenness, I told him there was some leftover spaghetti. While I washed dishes, he opened my refrigerator and helped himself, finding a pan and heating the spaghetti. He also served himself a glass of milk before he sat down at my kitchen table to eat and chat. His name was Larry. I noticed the Marine tattoo on his arm. He had been in Vietnam. Then he washed his dishes, thanked me, and rejoined his buddies. But before they left, Larry invited me to a neighborhood fair. I said yes. We ate, went on rides, and talked and talked and talked. Drinking a six-pack of Pepsi, we got pretty buzzed. I never thought you could get buzzed on six-packs of Pepsi. Maybe they put more caffeine in them back in those days. Well, anyway, let me back up here. Maybe the reason I was able to stay awake to keep talking, she writes, or maybe it was because we had so much to say to each other. We compared notes on our upbringings. From a different side of town, he was raised Catholic. I was Methodist. His family had two girls and a boy, same as mine, and he probably didn't ever want to get married. I didn't care unless I met the right guy. The next week, I moved in with roommates while Larry and his buddies moved into my old apartment. He started showing up Sunday nights with a bag of George Webb sliders. Whether I was home or not, my roommates liked that. Larry and I kept talking, became fast friends. We got engaged on Easter of 1967 and married in August 1968. And we still do a lot of talking. Lawrence Miles of Laredo, Texas writes, my mom, Patty, was tall for her age, to the point movie theaters tried to charge her the adult price, but one time her height worked to her advantage. The budget was tight for the Gale family in the 1940s, so 14-year-old Patty applied for a part-time job at the coffee shop called the Purple Cow. She convinced the manager to let her work as a counter server. To his credit, he tried to verify that she was 16, but Patty forgot to bring her birth certificate until the manager finally stopped asking. The coffee shop was at the Anderson Hotel, an entertainment hub in Anderson, Indiana, and celebrities visited with some frequency. Patty remembered serving the famous Johnny the Bellboy, Roventini, a cigarette salesman spokesman. A cigarette company sales spokesman. He was also an actor and musician, Smiley Burnett. I remember him as Charlie Pratt, the engineer of the Hooterville Cannonball on TV's Petticoat Junction. In my mom's time, Burnett was better known as Frog Milhouse, Gene Autry's comic sidekick. Smiley added Frog to his autograph for Patty, which he signed on the card promoting the restaurant's 65-cent special of beef stew, whipped potatoes, and cabbage. As an underage employee, Patty had one especially close call when her school principal stopped in for a Sunday. Nervous, she took great pains to provide excellent service, including an extremely generous serving of ice cream. Patty's deception was never detected. My mother graduated high school in 1947 and worked for 30 years in human resources for the local General Motors plant. But she never forgot her days meeting interesting people as a waitress at the Purple Cow. Excuse me. Piece together, quilt is tied to state's pioneer days, writes Julie Mann of Sentinel, Colorado. Ensign Smith, a great-great-grandfather of my husband Tom, was born in 1807 in New York. He left with his brothers and landed in New Mexico Territory. In 1936, he married a local woman, Juanita Ortiz. Ensign and Juanita were among the first pioneers to head to the Colorado Territory to seek gold. They built a small cabin in 1863. Ensign became the first of the probate judges in Golden City. He helped build the first toll road to Denver, believed to be where U.S. Highway 6 now lies. One of their eight children was Manuel, Tom's great-grandfather. Another was Susan, known as an exquisite quilter. In 1859, Susan began to make an applique, cock's comb, and prince's feather quilt using plants to dye the fabric. In her family's small cabin, she put the cotton blocks together using a Howe trading sewing machine her father brought to the territory on a wagon. Susan married in 1872 and busy with caring for a family. She didn't finish the border until 1917. Sometime after that, the quilt passed out of the family's hands. In 1998, an appraiser found it in an antique shop. An attached note signed by Lillian Putnam gave a partial story of its maker, Mrs. S.C. Susan Adair, and the appraiser placed an ad to find out more. Her search led to Susan Adair's great-granddaughter, Tom's cousin, Susan Beckner, who identified Lillian as Susan Adair's daughter and connected the creation of the quilt with the early story of Colorado. We saw the quilt in a show and admired the tiny stitches, reminders of a bygone day. I wish Tom's mother, Susan Adair's great-niece, had been able to learn the legacy of the oldest quilt in Colorado. Well, for Thanksgiving is just next week, and my wife and I went to the state fair this year, first time in, I don't know, many, many years. And there were some pumpkins out there that I believe was almost as big as one of those smart car automobiles. Now, I may be exaggerating a little bit, but it took forklifts to bring those things in there. They would probably feed most of the counties around here with the number of big pumpkins that we saw. So you could have pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving for at least, I'm sure, two counties worth of people. That was tremendous. I think one of the most fascinating things, and we went to see the animals and the flowers and stuff like that, was the goat show. I'd never seen a goat show that looked like, you know, if you've ever heard about or seen or watched a dog show, how they perform in a ring and get judged on their performance and how well they're built and manners and are they purebred and all that. But we watched a goat show that was absolutely amazing, and how they stood and just like the dog shows and where they were judged by their appearance and how well behaved, and it's amazing the different numbers and kinds of goats that were there, and also how much they would bring in the auction market. But I was telling my good friend Wade about that, and he said, yeah, when he was 10 years old, his dad went to buy a goat because it had a pasture that had a lot of briars in it, said he thought he was buying one goat and wound up bringing home a pickup load of goats. And one of them was a nanny, and Wade said he started milking that goat, and one of her neighbors had a lactose intolerant, and so would give him 25 cents a quart for the goat milk. So he said that really worked well, because back in those days, for a kid to have 25 cents was a big deal. So he would keep milking that goat, and the guy kept buying the quart of milk every time he had one, which happened to be twice a day. He said that little nanny goat was really good about the production of milk. But he said one day they were sitting in the kitchen, and his dad was drinking coffee, looked out the window, and one of those goats was standing on a fence post. So that was, he said, he came home from school the next day and said there were no more goats, and so there went his 25 cents a quart of milk, and he kind of really missed that goat after that. But anyway, that was just a great idea, great things to see at the North Carolina State Fair, and I was surprised at how easy it was to get in and out. I was kind of like dreading the drive and having to find place to park and all that, but we rode up Edwards Mill Road, and there were signs to a shuttle parking lot. Got on the bus, and they let us out at the front gate. We went in, and as a senior, you showed your ID, and boy, just walked right on in and had a great time looking at everything, and really enjoyed the day there. It was a beautiful day. Everything was very neat, orderly, and well run. So my hat's off to the North Carolina State Commission and what a good job they did there. So we hope maybe I'll put that on the list for something to do another year. But anyway, I got a number for you. Look at this number, 750,000. That's the number of parts in IBM's automatic sequence control calculator, which is a Mark I, their largest electromechanical calculator at the time. This was 1944. At 5 tons, 51 feet long, and 20 and 8 feet high, it was the first operational machine that can execute long computations automatically. And now most of our smartphones can do just about the same thing, I suspect. You know when the first electronic handheld calculator was done? 1967. In 1993, Apple released the first Newton PDA, or personal digit assistant, featuring a virtual digital calculator. And so over the next 10 years or so, virtual calculators became standard on mobile devices like the BlackBerry and iPhone, spelling the end of the independent calculator. Well, looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is broadcast available as a podcast after our broadcast at the website, ncradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time. Have a great day.